Your Honor, this appeal is here in this case for the second time, and I believe it presents a rather simple and fundamental question. After this court reverses a judgment by a trial court and sends the matter back for a new trial, must the evidence presented at the second trial be an exact duplicate of the first trial, especially in the case where the plaintiff in that case has undergone and continued to receive additional medical treatment after the first trial?
What did the trial judge say on that particular issue?
She said it would be a waste of time. She thought that my client was a quack, and she didn't want to waste any more time in discovery so we could develop the supplemental evidence.
Well, I'm going to assume for a moment that there's some legal standard to review your request, both at the trial level and here. Can you articulate that standard for us?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by this standard.
Well, there's one for newly discovered evidence.
Okay.
This isn't necessarily...
This is not
comfortably, in my mind, in newly discovered evidence. So what kind of standard do we apply to decide when what is at least facially relevant?
Right.
What standard for
the defendant in his briefs cites many cases where the court does not order a new trial based on newly discovered evidence, but this is not the primary basis for asking for the additional time was not for newly discovered evidence. It was for newly, and I'll use the term, created evidence.
New evidence.
Evidence that didn't exist at the time of the first trial, primarily. And I think, the research that I did, and I spent considerable time doing it.
Just two factual questions that may make it easier to understand the positions that are being taken on this appeal. Number one, is it correct that the trial judge barred you from introducing evidence of the additional medical expense that was incurred after the first appeal?
Yes.
That was out of the case, the $40,000.
I asked to reopen discovery to develop the record so the defense could examine those facts.
Well, I mean that.
And she said no.
Yeah, but there's a difference between reopening discovery.
Well.
And hear my question, please.
Okay.
Between opening discovery and holding that the newly incurred medical expense could not be admitted at a trial, put discovery from one side. Was there a did she bar the introduction of that evidence at trial?
She did not bar the evidence at trial because I never got to the point of offering it, because I don't think I could offer evidence that had not been disclosed to the defendant. So therefore, I had to ask for a new discovery period to extend discovery to develop the evidence so I could then offer it.
Yeah, I think one of the difficulties is couching it in terms of moving to extend time for discovery. But for those of us that have practiced in Superior Court in personal injury litigation, what we're talking about here is you needed to get an amendment to the pretrial stipulation, which would have disclosed to the other side this new evidence that you proposed to introduce. It would have given them time to explore that evidence, and you needed a window to get that done in order not to surprise somebody at trial and have it barred on the basis of surprise.
Exactly. What I asked to do is, can I open discovery to disclose this to the defendant, and then the defendant wants to take depositions, want more? I had to give them the records and the bills, and the only way I could do that, I think, would be
If you had not asked to amend the pretrial stipulation to open discovery for that purpose, and you just presented this for the first time at trial, what would have happened?
I assume the trial judge would have said, or the defendant would have said, surprise, I'm prejudiced, I've never had a chance to explore this.
Okay, let's go back to my question then. Mm-hmm. Now, as this is presented to us with that procedural context, what should be our guide for the future when this fact situation comes up and a trial judge denies your application to amend the pretrial stipulation and provide for the appropriate discovery period for the other side? How do we test that ruling?
First of all, with all due respect, I don't think you're talking about amending the pretrial stipulation.
I'm talking about
the trial scheduling order.
Well, I'm talking about the Rule 16.
Okay.
Where everyone discloses what they're going to present at trial so the other side isn't surprised.
The research that I have done, and there are two cases that jump out at me, one that I suggested and one the plaintiff cited, was the Andrews case out of Pennsylvania. It says with cases remanded for new trial, it's de novo as to all phases. And, in fact, the case that was cited by the defendant, the Department of Transportation versus
Mr. Aber,
First Star.
Excuse me. I'd like to hear the answer to the Chief Justice.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get to.
But did you amend, did you ask to amend the pretrial stipulation, yes or no?
No, because I didn't get, we didn't get to the pretrial stage yet. The pretrial.
You were at the pretrial stage. Until, you're always at the pretrial stage until you have a trial, Mr. Aber.
Maybe I just have trouble understanding.
Let's go back to the Chief Justice's question. In the way I read your brief, independent of the authorities you rely on, the proposition you're asserting is, if you go back for a new trial, as a matter of law, both sides should be able to introduce evidence of a change in circumstance.
Yeah, I think if the if a case is reversed and sent back for a new trial, the parties can enter new evidence, even that which was not evidence at the first trial, as long as there is no prejudice to the other party.
No, and both you're talking about a broader rule. Let's just stick with my question, which is a change in circumstance. In your brief, for example, you say if the person had recovered completely, or we can say hypothetically, if the person had a new job paying a lot of money and there was a claim for lost wages that would be attenuated, it would seem fair to both sides when you have a new trial that the new trial should be based on the status quo at the time of the new trial and not some hypothetical circumstance that existed at the first trial.
The question is that
you should say yes or no. Are you advocating a rule that if it's remanded for a new trial, as a matter of law, both sides are entitled to present evidence of a change in circumstance?
Absolutely. As I pointed out, my brief example is if the treatment at Johns Hopkins had cured my client, the defendant would clearly not want me to be able to present at the second trial a claim that for the rest of her life, she'd have permanent pain and suffering.
Okay, so the changed circumstances were the follow-up treatment and the cost of that, correct?
Yes.
And that information was, in fact, disclosed to the other side, was it not?
I had provided...
It was, in fact, disclosed to the other side,
yes,
was it not?
I had provided them both the records. I have provided them both the records as soon as I got them, and it was hard to get them out of Johns Hopkins. And the bills, which came before the records as soon as I got them.
So, to go back to the Chief Justice's question, you needed some vehicle to formalize that of record. One way to do it would have been to move to amend the pretrial schedule. But the way you chose to do it was to move to enlarge the discovery. Is that correct?
Is that correct? Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you. Now, was there any other discovery that you needed to take, or was the discovery that you contemplated only discovery that the other side would have the opportunity to take?
That's the only discovery that I contemplated doing was dealt with that Johns Hopkins issue.
Not your discovery, the other side's.
Yeah. Okay. The only issue that was going to need any attention to would be the Johns Hopkins issue. Now, in full frankness with the court, there were records that were used at the first trial all over the place, and that given the fact that those records were used without the physician's presence, I intended to ask the court whether, you know, to call those physicians in.
Let's just stay with this 42,000.
Right.
So going back to Justice Jacobs' question, as I understand it, you said to the trial judge, my client has incurred an additional $42,000 in expenses, and she's going to have to reimburse those additional expenses whenever she recovers, and I want that presented to the jury. And so we have that statement on the record. Now, all of us are asking you to put aside how you're going to present that to the jury or whether you're going to open discovery, amend the pretrial stipulation. But that's the question that the court said, I'm not hearing anything about the $42,000. It's out of the second trial.
That is what the court said. It's not just the $42,000. It's also the medical records and the treatment that you received.
Right, exactly.
I mean, they both had to come in.
Right.
And I'd never been faced with a situation before. The only way I thought it could be done fairly was to reopen discovery to give the defense.
I know that you're...
And the judge said, absolutely not.
Right. You seem to be losing the point that your choice procedurally is not as relevant to the court here as the issue of law that we're going to be deciding for the future. We can work out the mechanics if we know the legal principle that you're advocating.
I thought my mechanics were being criticized. I'm sorry. I think that, to answer the question, if there is a change of circumstances after the first trial that the party whose the change of circumstances affects has an absolute right as a matter of law to present that at the second trial. I think that states it as clear as
As long as it's relevant.
As long as it's relevant and there's no prejudice to the other side.
I don't want to read the trial judge's comments on the transcript unfairly, but they could be read to say, A, the relevance or irrelevance is not important to me. B, I don't have to articulate a standard for granting your request or rejecting it because I saw the first trial. I saw how the jury reacted. And what you're offering in addition for a second trial is not going to make any difference in the outcome. Therefore, I'm not wasting my time with this. Isn't that basically what she said?
That's basically what she said, and I think that's not the judge's prerogative. My client, unfortunately, does, I believe, suffer from bipolar disease, and she reacted perhaps inappropriately at the first trial. To say that she would act in the same way at the second trial and to prognosticate what the jury is going to think at the second trial is not the trial judge's prerogative. She is not to say, you're going to lose because your client's a quack, and I'm not going to allow you to present the evidence.
One other question related to that. And the judge referred to the fact that she'd spoken with the jurors and she knew why the jurors ruled against your client. Is there any record of how that conversation came about? Were the lawyers present, or how did the judge have this conversation where the jurors?
There's no record. There's nothing except what she wrote in. When she denied my motion to certify to this court, she wrote the letter and she enclosed the newspaper article. Quite frankly, I wanted to talk to the newspaper gentleman who wrote the column, and I checked with disciplinary counsel. I found out, and as I thought, I'm precluded from doing that because, you know, I think something was missed here. I don't know whether, in fact, they thought that she was double-dipping because of the issue for the first reversal. I don't know how much of that came into play. I mean, we have no idea what went on between, you know, here. The last thing I do wish to bring up, you know, and I do this with great hesitancy, I've never done this before, but given the trial rulings of the first trial and given the nature of this court's comments the second time, as I said, if the court chooses to reverse the trial court's ruling that's been presented, I am asking that it be directed that this be assigned to a different judge. And I understand how unusual that is, but I have serious doubts of what's going to happen if this case is going to go back for a second trial, but doubts about what will happen. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Bill Durler, and I represent the defendants in this matter. I think what both parties agree to at this point after receiving the reply brief is that the scope of the remanded trial is dictated by the mandate of the court.
What do you think about this question that as a matter of law, when there's a new trial, either party should be able to present evidence of a change in circumstance?
I disagree. I think that that's a too broad a rule. I think there may be some support for that if there's a change in the law in the meantime. There may be certain limited circumstances where that may apply. I don't think that it applies in every case.
Well, let's just talk about a change in facts, not the law.
Okay.
Let's suppose someone had a claim for lost wages, and it was a significant lost wages claim, and it goes back for a new trial. And in the interim, the person's won the lottery, and we'll hypothetically say they won $200 million. Is that going to be relevant? That's a factual circumstance, not a change in the law.
I think that in that circumstance, you should probably apply the newly discovered evidence rule that the plaintiff advocated.
Well, it wasn't available to be discovered at the first trial.
No, it was not. But
it's new evidence. It's not newly discovered evidence.
Correct. And in that case, it probably wouldn't affect the trial. I think, first of all, that in your hypothetical, that's a collateral source.
All right. So I have a different hypothetical.
Okay.
Let's suppose there's a struggling lawyer who can't make much money practicing law, and he has a claim for lost wages, and then in the interim gets appointed to the federal bench with a lifetime salary that's multiples of what they were earning in private practice. Is it relevant that they're now a lifetime judge making multiples of what they were making as a lawyer?
I think it's relevant if you are inclined to consider the change in circumstance. I think in this case, I think you don't need to reach that issue or make that law. Because of the facts of this case, this was not a change in circumstance.
Well, Mr. Durler, Justice Holland, in response to Justice Holland's question, I understand you to be arguing that there's no broad legal proposition that would entitle a party who successfully obtained a new trial and a remand to prove evidence of changed circumstances. I gather what you're arguing is that that would be discretionary and it would be decided on a case-by-case basis?
Yes. I think that you should consider issues such as prejudice.
Is there any case law on that subject? We're not talking about newly discovered evidence, but new evidence.
Well, there is case law that distinguishes between new evidence and newly discovered evidence.
That isn't my question. You're challenging the legal argument that's being made here. You argue that the argument is too broad, that there is no absolute legal right. There is a discretionary call that the trial judge would be able to determine on a case-by-case basis. My question is, I've got two questions. One is, do you have any authority for that proposition? And secondly, if that were to be the rule, how would it operate? That is, what would guide the exercise of discretion? And wouldn't it be an abuse of discretion here, even if there were a discretionary standard?
Certainly it wouldn't be an abuse of discretion in this case because the evidence at issue is not newly discovered. It's not new evidence. It's not new evidence because in this case
it happened after the trial.
I understand that, but her need for future care was not a new issue. She was aware, and her expert testified that she would need care into the future.
Yeah, but there's a dollar value that can now be attached to that, and then that not only the future care, but now a new dollar amount for past care. That is, the evidence that would be put into the trial record, if it were allowed, would be not only did I incur X dollars up to the time of the first trial, but since the first trial, I've incurred another $42,000.
Well, let's assume for the purpose of answering that very question that the plaintiff did introduce the need for future care and expert testimony about what that care was likely to be and an estimated cost of that future care. Was that all in the record at the first time?
The cost of the care was not. The expert testified that she would need the care, but for whatever reason, there was no dollar figure attached to that.
Now, does it make sense in a new trial to repeat that evidence that, A, she would need future care, and, B, if it could be testified to, that future care might cost, given today's circumstances, X number of dollars, in light of the fact she indeed got future care, and we know what the dollar amount was. Does that make any sense?
It doesn't make any sense in this case, Your Honor, because they didn't have that evidence at trial well enough to even submit future expenses. I'm not sure what the effort was to investigate what the expense would be. Dr. Bowes never gave a figure or a monthly estimate, or if he did, I can't recall. But there was never any present value calculation attached to putting that future cost into the case. So this case went forward with the fact, knowing the fact that she would need future care.
Just a generalized statement that she will need future care.
Right. She would continue to have pain in the future, and there was no evidence, you know, there was no actual evidence as to specifically what that would be.
But now we have actual evidence. That future care, at least measured from the time of the first trial, was at least $40,000 in value. And that's evidence that could be sworn to and put into the record. Now, my question is, what is the justification for excluding that evidence from a second trial, even under a discretionary standard?
The justification is that the evidence with the experts that went forward was based upon estimates. It was not a sum certain in any event at the first trial.
How does that argument fit into your? I mean, how do you translate that argument into a rule of law that would provide guidance to the bench and the bar?
You may distinguish between testimony at the first trial of past damages versus testimony at the first trial of future damages, which are historically based upon estimates.
All right, Mr. Dorler, let's suppose at the first trial they said the person's going to need an operation in the future, and the operation is going to cost $100,000. That's the testimony at the first trial. It's an estimate.
Correct.
And then we're in a situation where there's going to be a new trial, and the operation has occurred, and the operation actually cost $50,000. As I understand the rule of law you're advocating, they would still get to present the testimony that it's estimated the operation would cost $100,000, even though the operation actually occurred and only cost 50. Is that correct?
I think that's right, Your Honor. What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
So that if you wanted to introduce evidence to the effect that no, there may be an estimate of 100, but in fact the operation only cost 50, the judge could properly, in the exercise of her discretion, keep that out.
I think. I think we're all jumping the gun and forgetting that what dictates the scope of the new trial is the mandate and what was it reversed for.
I think the only thing that we're trying to focus on is if the trial occurred and there were circumstances which were going to continue subsequent to the trial, and the trier of fact was trying to anticipate what the appropriate compensation would be for the continuing circumstances. And then you get to the second trial, and circumstances have continued as predicted, and they're quantifiable. Why shouldn't the jury or the trier of fact at the second trial know about what's been quantified and estimate what may be left? What we're having trouble understanding is why you feel, as a matter of law, something that was a prediction at the first trial but has now become fixed and is quantifiable should be withheld from the second trial.
Because the discovery is done, and we're opening up a whole can of worms. As Mr. Aber said, that's, you know, he started with this, now he's going to go back and he's going to try and get some other experts in that to testify, to clarify some records, and you know, so you're opening up a whole can of worms as to, change of circumstances are.
Do you agree that if she gets a recovery, whatever it is, that she's going to have to repay this $42,000 out of that recovery, and yet the trier of fact at the second trial is not going to know that additional $42,000 expense was actually incurred?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's just unfortunate for her.
It's not unfortunate. She had an obligation to put on evidence of what her expected future expenses were going to be at that first trial. She didn't do it. She's now getting a second bite at the apple. Had she put on the proper evidence?
But a new trial is a second bite at the apple, isn't it, Mr. Driller?
Not for all causes, no, Your Honor. I disagree with that.
Well, is it your position that at a second trial, the only change that can occur from the first trial is whatever is necessary to correct the error that was found on appeal to have occurred? That is, the record is frozen from the moment that trial, the first trial is over, except for that little portion that may have that involved error, reversible error. That can be changed, but nothing else.
I believe that's what the law is now, and I believe that's correct. The errors so in this case.
The videotape has been taken of the first trial. Basically, what the court would be justified in doing is playing back that entire videotape, save perhaps for that portion that was the subject of the reversible error.
No. I don't think they're limited to putting on exactly the same case. I think the record is frozen as far as discovery. I don't believe that they have to put on exactly every single witness they put on before. They could make that change. We're talking about whether there's a difference between whether they have to put on the same exact trial or whether they have to put on the trial based upon the evidence and the discovery that had previously taken place. And that's
frozen, correct?
Yes.
For all time.
That's correct. Unless the error that was made at trial impacted the pretrial procedures.
Apart from the trial judge's views on the efficacy of any trial at all, given the way she read the evidence, that's basically her conclusion, the bright-line rule that Justice Jacobs just put to you, which is if there's going to be a new trial, it's going to be the same trial that was tried before, but for any correction that resulted from the Supreme Court's failure to understand what was really going on in the first place, which is, to be candid, what the trial judge said. This case is coming back because the Supreme Court just doesn't get it, but I get it because I saw the result of the trial, and I'll do what I have to do. But we're not doing anything more than exactly what we did the first time with the correction that the Supreme Court ordered. That's basically the bright line rule that she didn't articulate but was in her mind when she barred Mr. Haber from either amending a scheduling order, amending a pretrial stipulation, or, as a practical matter, barred him from introducing this post-trial evidence.
I think that's a little bit of a hard-line rule of what she actually did. I think if you look at what she did, she read the order, she read the mandate. If you read the language of the mandate...
Well, putting the mandate aside, didn't she say on the record that the Supreme Court was looking at a paper record and didn't understand the dynamics of the trial?
I believe that she may have used that as an alternative basis, but I believe that the basis, if you read her, what she said, was the Supreme Court reversed it for a new trial, and it's a new trial to be exactly with the same deadlines. It's done. She also said the decision was made by the Supreme Court that there was an error in the way it was presented, and we're going to present it without error. It isn't going to be an ongoing 10-year process. That's not going to happen. I think she was certainly within her rights to read your order that way. To the extent that it's an abuse of discretion standard, I think that it was not an abuse of discretion to interpret the order and the mandate to order a new trial based upon the record that was there and to correct the errors that were discovered in the opinion, and that's what led to the remand.
Well, let's assume that is absolutely correct. And let's assume that when the mandate went back, we would have anticipated exactly that. Those aren't the circumstances. The circumstances are that there has been an event that didn't exist at the time of the first trial that has an effect on issues that were presented at the first trial. And that event is actual damages arguably related to the injuries caused by an accident. $42,000 worth of bills that relate to those injuries, none of which factually existed before the mandate. So the mandate couldn't have anticipated this. The problem we have to deal with now is, what is the standard that we apply to review a trial judge's ruling that new evidence does not come in at the second trial? There is a bright line rule that Justice Jacobs articulated, which makes sense. There's the bright line rule that your colleagues articulated, which arguably makes sense, and that is anything that's due ought to come in, period. It's not excluded expressly by the mandate, so it ought to come in. And I hope you're not articulating for some kind of case-by-case let's call them as we see them, middle ground, because that is, in my view, a horribly slippery slope.
Well, I think, Your Honor, you're getting into a case-by-case analysis. I mean, it's just a matter of you're asking for somebody to set up or to suggest a rule to you. And I think that what you should, if you're going to go that route.
Well, tell us the alternative. I don't like rules. If we can avoid articulating a rule or some doctrinal principle, happily we'll avoid it. But how is it avoidable in this situation?
Well, I mean, it's avoidable if you follow the dictates of the mandate and the opinion and limit it. I think you can avoid it that way.
But that would be the rule, that okay. It's limited to the way things stood at the first trial and nothing that's happened after the first trial that's arguably relevant to an issue presented in the first trial will be admissible in the second trial. That's the rule you're advocating.
The rule, yes, and if you need a different rule, I mean, if you're looking for something else, I think that what the standard for the newly discovered evidence is something that should be considered, where that you must have reasonable diligence, and things like one factor. There must be reasonable diligence in this new evidence coming
you
forward.
You told us earlier that there's case law that distinguishes between new evidence and newly discovered evidence. What is that articulated distinction?
I believe the Bechtel, I'm not sure I'm saying it right, B-A-T-C-H-L-E. That case, the newly discovered, in that case, there was a divorce hearing, and they subsequent to the hearing, somebody sold the house that was the subject, and they sold it for more money. And they wanted to come back and say that there should be a new trial because now we know how much the house cost. And in that case, the court said you don't get to have a new trial on the issue of damages or just splitting it up because that, in fact, is not newly discovered evidence. It's new evidence. So you don't get to have a retrial. And I believe that case has been followed
and
elsewhere.
You would equate the appraisal of the house to there was in issue at the first trial future treatment for pain and whatever it may cost. Just as there was an issue of what the house was worth in the Bechtel case, and the fact that the house was sold for more than was estimated at the first trial is not admissible in a second trial or wouldn't be a catalyst for a second trial. And so wouldn't actual known future costs be in this situation? That's the analogy you would draw?
It's very similar because in that case, subsequently, They are aware of exactly what it cost to sell the house, and here, so you're aware that for this period of time she had these same expenses.
But was that a circumstance where there was already a new trial ordered for other reasons?
No, that was a motion.
Does that
for
make
a new
difference?
Trial. I don't think it should. The fact is that there were both trials, and the trials were conducted, and there were limited errors.
Let me make sure I understand this. There's no difference between the appraisal being the catalyst for an entirely new trial, absent any other reason, and the fact that there's been a new trial ordered for another reason and a later significant change in circumstances has occurred, that's in fact new evidence. There's no distinction between the two that makes any sense?
No, because I think that the reasons for foreclosing discovery and limiting them to particularly where there's future estimates involved, that the same reasons apply as to why you wouldn't want to have a whole new trial, or why would you want to reopen it to allow a whole new trial on everything when there was only very specific errors.
And what's the prejudice to your client of having this evidence come in?
Prejudice to my client is that, first of all, she had a trial. She was aware she had future damages, and she didn't put any evidence on about exactly what that was going to be. She made no real estimate of she didn't put on anybody to say, oh, she's going to have $300,000 a month in medical expenses. There's evidence that she was continuing to treat.
Are you saying that the prejudice to your client is that now the plaintiff has a stronger damage case?
Is that now she gets to retry a case and make the mistakes
better? Well, she gets
better.
To retry the case anyway. But we're talking about the prejudice of putting in evidence of the $42,000.
I think the prejudice, yes, that she would get a stronger case. She would get to redo it, and The point is, and there is no prejudice to her because she had a full opportunity to put this on.
Justice Holland's question was, what is the prejudice to your client? 8 more minutes in the courtroom in the second trial? The need to take the deposition of a doctor who administered the pain treatment that cost $42,000? The time it takes to review the medical records that substantiate that? Increased exposure?
Well, what's the prejudice to your client?
I think
that's his question.
I think
how does it help the other side?
The prejudice is that they've had a chance to put on their case once, and now they get to put it on again with new strategies, new evidence. I think that's prejudicial. And, you know, I guess arguably, you know, at any time you want to seek to reopen discovery, you can argue that there is no prejudice because you can just extend a deadline. You know, then again, you're constantly going to be looking at evidence every time there's been a change in circumstance on appeal, even if the error didn't lead to the appeal.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Your Honor, just so it's clear as to the rule that I would advocate, if I did not make myself clear, I apologize. If there has been a change of circumstances, it's really a two-part rule. If there's been a change of circumstances, that change of circumstances should come into the second trial as a matter of right. Secondly, a little broader, at a second trial, issues that were tried the first time can be expanded upon by other witnesses that were not used in the first trial. In other words, it's just all phases. You don't have to go back and basically read the transcript from the first trial back to the jury. And I think that's what the defense is advocating. But getting to the specific arguments, no one was aware at the first time that Ms. Wright was going to go to Johns Hopkins Pain and Clinic for a month's in-house hospitalization. The prediction was she would need additional pain medication. After the first trial, she went to a new doctor. He got her admitted down there, and no one anticipated that at the first trial. Secondly, the thought that is Chief Judge Steele put out, that the court below thought causation was an issue and there would be no different result. I think all of our experience shows that in many cases, this court has reversed the case and it's gone back and there's been a different result. I mean, criminal cases all the time, you have people who come up here who have been convicted, you've reversed, and they go back and they get acquitted. The causation will be viewed differently by a different jury. And for the judge to sit there and say, I'm going to say that because the first jury didn't buy your causation argument, I think your second trial is a waste of time, is something that exceeds her jurisdiction, her discretion. And finally, the last thing, you know, it's the causation. It may have been my fault that I presented it badly. The jury was blinded by the double-dipping argument. But the evidence at the first trial was uncontradicted that the second accident did cause an injury. The question was it 75-25 or 25-75? But no one disputed that both doctors who testified, the treating doctor and the IME doctor, both said the second accident caused an injury. So for the trial court to say, I'm not going to let you present new evidence of damages that didn't exist but now exist because I think causation is a waste of time, I think is an abuse of discretion. And I think the nature of her comments existed that. But again, the rule that I would say, if there's been a change of circumstances, that evidence comes in as a matter of right. And if you, at the second trial, you can present different witnesses on the same issues that were presented at the same time at the first trial. I don't believe you can bring in whole new issues or whole new theories, but new witnesses on the same issues can be presented. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.